This is the TTY Dialer, episode 25 for the week of April 17th through April 22nd. Hi there, welcome to another edition of WRVO's weekly companion podcast to our old-time radio show tuned to yesterday. I'm Mark Livonier, and in this episode I'll be bringing you some radio history, some fun with sound from radio's past, and a look at the shows coming up for the week on Tune to Yesterday, where every single night from 10 to midnight you can hear comedy, drama, mystery, westerns, action, science fiction, and much, much more, broadcast in what we like to call your theater of the mind.
Let's leave the scene of our play for a moment and take a little journey. We'll let a bottle of Roma wine serve as Aladdin's lamp. I touch the label and presto, we're all transported to that capital of gaiety, Havana, Cuba. And now we find ourselves in the charming Pan-American Club. At a table nearby, an American has just voiced his delight at the uncommon beauty of the scene. Then his Cuban companion responds, "You in America also have much that is uncommon to boast of, such as this marvelous tasting wine we are enjoying this minute. To enjoy uncommon fine quality, Cuba imports this wine from your own distant California. It is your superb Roma wine. Now just realize what it means when other countries import Roma wines from such great distances. Such international esteem must mean that Roma wines are truly magnificent in quality. And then consider this. You here in America need pay no high import duty, no expensive shipping charges. For these fine Roma wines come from Roma's own wineries in the heart of the rich California wine grape districts. Because so many Americans do realize this good fortune, Roma wines are America's largest selling wines. So why deny yourself this taste delight? Try an inexpensive bottle of tangy, appetizing Roma sherry, or the hearty Roma Burgundy, or any of the marvelously enjoyable Roma wines. But remember, these days your favorite dealer may be temporarily out of the type you prefer. Then please try again. Ask for R-O-M-A, Roma Wines, made in California for enjoyment throughout the world.
That was a commercial for the sponsor of radio's long-running thrill show, Suspense. It enjoyed success on CBS Radio for about 20 years, and no small part to the early support of Roma Wines. When the company signed on in 1943, after the show was on the air for just about a year, there were several terms the company demanded of the show, and CBS that would end up really benefiting the program beyond what it had expected, and for Roma, its sales. Now, part of the agreement was to have Suspense air in a permanent time slot, and to also hire a well-known pitchman for their show advertisements. And in this case, it was the commercial spokesman on the horror show Lights Out, who had pitched for Ironized Yeast Tablets, Frank Martin, who landed the gig. And in the 4 years or so that Roma sponsored the show, as the money lining their registers was increasing, so did the support for the program, which typically cast well-known Hollywood actors in tales of suspense. And the more money in their budget, the bigger the star they could hire on. Talents like Orson Welles, Vincent Price, Alan Ladd, Lucille Ball. Also, the actress known as the First Lady of Suspense, who would star in a risky, practically one-woman performance of Lucille Fletcher's now-famous play Sorry Wrong Number, which would be repeated 7 more times on the series. Also, several actors not known to act in noir-style suspenseful plays. The first, under the Roma wine sponsorship, being the no-doubt pricey talent of Cary Grant in the play The Black Curtain.
I ducked down behind the store window and watched him. He looked over in my direction and then up and down the street. Oh, then he lit a cigarette and strolled down the corner. The minute he disappeared, I yanked the door open, dashed out, ran across the Tillery Apartments and went in.
And according to author Martin Grams, a rep for the Roma Wine Company at the time, once made the comment that when Cary Grant comes to the suspense microphone, he acts all over the place. Coming up this Monday night on Tune to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, the Lux Radio Theater brings us an hour of mystery with A Blueprint for Murder, that movie adapted from 1954. Then I have 3 westerns for you at 11. It's the Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters Show, A Treasury Salute to Buffalo Bill from 1944, then an episode of Have Done Will Travel from 1960.
I talked to your chief engineer. He figures that with what we've managed to save from the fire, we've got enough to finish the job.
He still thinks it can be done in time?
Well, providing we can haul those tires down from the canyon immediately, but we'll need every mule in the county.
Oh, well, you know who has all the mules in the county.
Yeah. And I'm going to make a deal to hire them.
Oh, you're out of your mind.
Maybe. but it's worth a try.
On this Tuesday night show, it's comedy from the Screen Director's Playhouse for a full hour from 1951, then true history from another three programs, Captains of Industry from 1937, Adventures in Research, and The Cavalcade of America from 1940. Hear these programs coming up Monday, April 17th, and Tuesday, April 18th, from 10 to midnight on Tune to Yesterday. And by the way, you'll be hearing new shows this week as well. That Lux Radio Theater broadcast hasn't been heard in years on our station, and it's now part of the Tune to Yesterday catalog. Also, that Hour of True History with those three programs, new as well. So I am adding to our collection of hours, basically, of Tune to Yesterday. We're at about 1,700 and change at this point. So hopefully you won't be hearing too many repeats as time goes on the show. Among the many what was referred to as breakfast shows or morning programs to thrive during the golden age of radio, the team of Tex and Jinx made their radio debut this Saturday, April 22nd in 1946 on NBC affiliate WEAF in New York. They had an 8:30 time slot, and they were immensely popular in their 13 years on the air, where they would talk about current events, interview celebrities, and just have a conversation at a time where this kind of show was becoming a popular format. Leading up to the show, Tex McCrary, whose actual name was John Reagan, had been an intrepid journalist for the Hearst newspapers in New York, and in the Second World War had been an Army Air Corps colonel, reportedly leading the first group of journalists into the ruins of Hiroshima after it was bombed. Before this, when McCrary was working for the New York Daily Mirror, he was sent to interview the actress and cover girl model Jinx Falkenberg, whose actual name was Eugenia Falkenberg, for a Broadway musical she was in, and things took off with the two that started a wartime romance as she entertained the troops and he served as one. Now, Jinx was known most for her modeling for hundreds of magazine covers and some notable screen work in Hollywood, and she married Tex in June of 1945. Less than a year later, they made their radio debut on the program called Hi Jinx, which was later named to Tex and Jinx, and the show was really steered by Tex, who worked under the belief that many people in the morning are ready for weighty issues and intelligent conversation. So with his drier delivery and Jinx's thoughtful and even provoking questions, the show really hit the mark, and although it was based in New York, it was talked about the nation over. At one point, they did have a half-hour show as a substitute for the comedy program Duffy's Tavern a year after they started on radio, but that only lasted a summer. So here's some sound from one of their broadcasts where, before this clip, the suicide of a former U.S. ambassador to Great Britain and the Cold War were discussed. There was an interview with the aviation editor of the New York Daily Mirror on Howard Hughes' plane, The Spruce Goose, and this conversation with a special guest from November 4th, 1947.
Well, Jinx, two plays opened last night, and I'm afraid neither one of them got a green light from the critics this morning.
No, I'm afraid we cannot give a green light to either of the plays that opened last night, This Time Tomorrow or, oh dear, Trial Honeymoon. I pushed the papers aside, but I do think that we can give a sort of preview a green light for Edith Piaf, the famous French chanteuse, who's singing at the Playhouse. Is that the way you pronounce it?
I think so. I grinned, but I couldn't do any better. She
famous
sings,
French
anyhow.
Singer, yes. And I understand from several people who've been trying to get tickets that she's sold out for the coming 4 weeks that she's going to be there. We'll be seeing it Thursday night, and then we'll be able to give a first-hand green light, I know.
On Friday morning. But now, Jinx, I think we have a very special green light for Orbach's this morning.
Yes, for those cameo Gibson girl blouses in a mother and daughter combination.
Too bad they don't make them in mother and son combination. But anyway,
yes.
You mean that mothers and daughters can both wear matching blouses?
Yes, and the particular blouse that I'm talking about is a lovely striped chambray in rose, maize, or lime stripes on gray. And it has full puffs, Gibson sleeves. I can't talk this morning. I'm going to start all over again. It has full puffed Gibson sleeves, and around its high neck is a detachable grosgrain ribbon with an adorable cameo. And I think if you just look a little bit to the right, Tex, you'll see me wearing one of the blouses, but in plain white instead of the stripe. Do you like it?
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Do you?
Try some with stripes.
All right. And I wish, as you say, that I had a little girl so that she could wear the daughter combination, but since I
No
haven't...
propaganda.
All right.
Ask Ruth McCabe. Anyway, these can be found on the main floor of either store in sizes 32 to 38 for mothers.
And for the daughters, you'll find sizes 7 to 14 and 10 to 16 on the fourth floor in the New York store and in the downstairs store in Newark.
In Newark, New Jersey. Now, Jinx, about our next guest. Our next guest is Walt Disney, the film father of a certain little animal famous all over the world. In Soviet Russia, he's known as Mickey Mouse. And in Spain, I hope my accent's all right.
In Spain, they call him Miguel Ratoncito. Brazilians know him as Comandongo Mickey. And in Argentina, he's El Raton Mickey.
And the French have given him the name of Michel Souris. And in Japan, it's Mickey Cucci. But here at home, we all know Walt Disney's most famous cartoon character, just as Mickey Mouse.
Well, Tex, you know Walt Disney was only 10 years old when he did his first commercial artwork. He used to get a free haircut every week in his hometown of Marceline, Missouri, and for sketches that he drew and gave to the barber to display on the walls of his shop. And then at 16, he was in Chicago taking a night course in cartooning at the Academy of Fine Arts.
But about this time, the First World War broke out, and Walt was too young to join the Army, but he managed to get overseas as an ambulance driver for the Red Cross. And then after the war, he began making his first animated cartoons in Kansas City, and he called them Laugh-O-Grams.
Well, people must not have laughed very much because the company failed, and Walt packed up and went to Hollywood to try his luck. And that's when Mickey Mouse was born, exactly 20 years ago. In fact, they just celebrated the 20th anniversary last week. And then, of course, Walt Disney was on his way to fame.
You know, Jenks, there's a lot of stories about the origin of Mickey. One says that the original was a little fellow who lived in a wastebasket where Walt worked in Kansas City. The mouse got so tame, he used to run across the top of his drawing board, and Walt made friends with him and named him Mickey.
Well, I don't know about that story, Tex, but Mickey was just the beginning, that I do know. Then came Donald Duck, the three little pigs, Goofy and Pluto and the big bad wolf, and oh, so many others. You know, Walt Disney's cartoons have won over a dozen Academy Awards in the short subjects division. And Walt doesn't draw much of the cartoons anymore, but he still supervises every detail of their productions.
And that means working round the clock in busy times. I wonder how many people know, though, that Walt is the voice of Mickey Mouse.
I didn't know that until just the other day.
Well, you'll find out again in a minute, but now let's switch to transcription, Jenks, and listen to your interview with Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse's boss.
Hello, Walt.
Hello. hello, Jinx.
Hi, Walt. Now, let me see, what was that character?
Well, that was just a sort of a slip into a mouse.
Oh, that was a slip into a mouse. Yeah. What's the last word that I've heard about the mouse, that you've built a better mouse? Can you help me out on that?
Oh, that's the old better mousetrap gag, yeah.
Well, what is it?
Well, they beat a path to your door.
And you've built a better mouse.
Well,
Mickey Mouse. Yeah. And how, Walt, I wonder if you wouldn't help me with a little build-up for you, for your pictures. I want to just sort of go back over the past and find out what the first big picture that you made. I don't mean all the Mickey Mouses and Donald Ducks, but what was your first full-length feature?
Oh, Snow White.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
That's when you were just a little girl.
About 7 years ago, wasn't it?
Oh, it's almost 10.
Is it really?
Uh-huh.
That was a wonderful picture. That was the first full-length feature.
Yeah.
Who were some of the singers behind the scenes in that?
We had a little girl by the name of Casalotti from the opera family.
Mm-hmm. You had really an opera singer in the picture.
Well, her father was an opera coach, and her sister was a famous Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Los Angeles girl.
And then what came next? Did Fantasia come next?
Oh, gosh. What? Yes.
We have to go back 10 years now and pick up the remains.
No, Pinocchio.
Pinocchio. And then Fantasia.
I think so. Uh-huh. Fantasia, and then Dumbo, and Bambi, and...
Bambi was a beautiful picture.
Well, we're bringing Bambi out this year again. It's going to come out and run all over again.
It'll be reissued.
Well, we give it a new start.
Oh, I see. Well, I think that you must have had great reaction from parents all over the world on that picture, didn't you, Walt?
Oh, yes. It's considered now one of the best.
And what about children? Did you get any special letters from children, any reaction from them?
Well, no, but I did from hunters.
Did you? What did they say?
Oh, they said that they couldn't face their children when they come home with the deer over the front of the car, you know, because... They're going out and shot the deers.
And they thought it was Bambi.
That's right. They couldn't... Well, I had all the honey magazines down on me on account of that picture.
This Wednesday night on Tune to Yesterday at 10, it's an hour of science fiction. Two programs. We have 2000 Plus from 1950 with the story Men from Mars, then Dimension X from the same year. After that, it's an hour of crime. We'll have Danger with Granger, then The Whistler from 1954. On this Thursday night at 10 o'clock, it's drama from the Orson Welles show, This Is My Best. then the CBS Radio Workshop with an interesting broadcast called The No Plays of Japan.
Today, the workshop offers an unusual departure in radio drama, a free adaptation of 14th century Japanese theater based on Arthur Whaley's translations of the classic No Plays of Japan, adapted by Harvey Marlowe. Music composed and conducted by the noted Japanese composer, Takshindo.
At 11 o'clock this Thursday, it's Horror from Dark Fantasy and Lights Out, which brings us the story Lord Marley's Guest from 1943. So you can hear these programs Wednesday, April 19th, and Thursday, April 20th, from 10 to midnight, live on the air on Tune to Yesterday, or as we stream it live at our website, wrvo.org. One of the best-remembered silent film comedy stars, known for his hanging from the clock tower scene in 1923's Safety Last, Harold Lloyd was born this Thursday, April 20th, in 1893. And from the start of World War I to just after the conclusion of the Second, he acted and was involved in about 200 movies in the 1920s, even surpassing Charlie Chaplin's popularity and annual salary with his on-screen daring for laughs and a sharp timing when just poking fun at life. Through all of his on-screen work, he wasn't just a paid actor, but he was heavily involved in crafting each film and became part of the history of innovative photography as well, as some of the first tests for the Technicolor process were performed at his home. Now, hearing a primarily visual comedian on the radio like Red Skelton or even Jack Benny, one might think that the transition was pretty easy. But in the case of Harold Lloyd turning to radio, his effort proved to be, let's say, historically noteworthy, but relatively uneventful. As the story goes, Harold's friend and one-time movie collaborator Preston Sturges was offered the hosting job of a new show that was to emulate the Movies on the Air program, the Lux Radio Theater, bringing film actors to the air to reprise their original roles, and it tried to set itself apart by being the only half-hour that focused on the comedy blockbusters of the day on the screen. So Sturges ended up turning down the hosting job and recommended Harold Lloyd instead, which ended up sending Lloyd into frenzied preparations, as this would be his first full-time radio job. Apparently, he rehearsed for weeks, recording every second of practice delivery, which he analyzed through the night, only to get up the next day and do it all again. And when the new show hit the air, live in October 1944, he surprised audiences with an even, and at times nervous, pace to his delivery. And for someone who would do repeated takes in movies, like most actors, being live, probably couldn't blame him that much for having that nervousness. But it would smooth itself out by the end of the first season, and that was all NBC Radio was willing to carry. So the show was canceled, and some say it was Harold Lloyd's lack of experience or the heavily condensed movies that were to blame. And for about 30 years, the shows were thought to be lost to the ages until they were discovered after Harold Lloyd's death, stored in his basement. 29 of the 32 programs produced were in excellent condition, thanks to his sense of posterity. Let's hear some sound from the fourth episode of that show now, from November 19th, 1944.
From Hollywood, California, the makers of Old Gold Cigarettes present The Comedy Theater, the only radio program that brings you every week the greatest stars in the greatest comedies. Tonight's play, Vivacious Lady, starring Lee Bowman and Linda Darnell. And here is the director of the Old Gold Comedy Theater, Mr. Harold Lloyd.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. All right, cast, on stage, everybody. Everyone here? Fine. Now, let me see. Do any of you boys know what leptosporangiate means?
Not me. I can't even say.
Never heard.
Certainly. Breaking down the etymology of the word, we have lepto, meaning delicate, spora, meaning seed, angiate, a case or vessel, that is, leptosporangiate, a seed case which forms from a single delicate cell.
Oh, fine. Good for you, Lee Bowman. You play Peter Morgan III.
Well, that's swell, Harold. But what has leptosporangiate got to do with it, and why Peter Morgan III?
Just a little typecasting, Lee. You see, Peter is a professor of biology at Old Sharon University, where his grandfather, Peter I, was president, and where his father, Peter II, is now president, and where you, Peter III, may be president someday.
Wow, a dynasty.
And how? Now, Jack Edwards, Jr., you play Peter's cousin, Keith Bester.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Is he a professor, too?
Oh, no. He's the black sheep of the family.
Oh, more typecasting, huh?
Well, no, he's not really bad. He just has a couple of bad habits.
He has?
Yes, he likes whiskey and pretty girls.
I do.
So, about twice a year, he runs off to New York and goes on a spree. That's where you come in, Lee. Your father, President Morgan II, sends you to New York to bring Keith back to Old Sharon.
Is there a girl?
Is there? Oh, boy. Take a look.
Oh, she's wonderful. Who is she?
Francie Brandt, a nightclub singer, played by Linda Darnell.
Oh, Harold, I think Lee's wonderful, too.
You see, Peter, you've been all over New York for Keith. And finally, you find him in the nightclub where Francie sings.
Excuse me, mister.
That's okay, bud.
Excuse me. Wait a
minute. Coming up this Friday night on Tune to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, it's sitcoms with the Aldrich family and Our Miss Brooks. Then Adventure for an Hour at 11 with episodes of Rocky Fortune and 1950s Cloak and Dagger.
Are you willing to undertake a dangerous mission behind the enemy lines, knowing you may never return alive?
What you have just heard is the question asked during the war to agents of the OSS, ordinary citizens who to this question answered, yes.
This is Cloak and Dagger.
The Saturday Night True History with Biographies and Sound program, putting the wonderful world of Robert Benchley in focus. It's really a great show. And at 11 o'clock Saturday night, it's Westerns from the Screen Director's Playhouse with Bob Hope and the Roy Rogers Show from 1951. Hear these shows this Friday and Saturday night from 10 to midnight on Tune to Yesterday on the air on WRVO or at our website, wrvo.org. So this is podcast number 25 of the TTY Dialer, and at the end of this, we'll have about 9 hours worth of podcasts posted at our website. So if you've missed a couple or do the binge listening thing, I invite you to do that at the place where you found us in the first place, at wrvo.org. Also there, our monthly broadcast schedule is typed out for you so you can plan your listening around Tune to Yesterday and what nights work out for you. Okay, that's going to do it for now. So if you have any questions for me about old-time radio, this podcast, or Tune to Yesterday, just send me an email. My address is mark@wrvo.org. That's mark@wrvo.org. Thanks a lot for listening, and you'll be hearing from me again next week.